Welcome back to Hour 2 of Open Mind. Tonight, I'm Bill Jenkins, delighted to have you along, and certainly delighted, finally, after all of these years, to have in studio with me Mr. Thomas E. Bearden, who has been teaching us for so much for so long. John Bedini is here, the young man who took the theories that Tom talked about and made them reality. Steve Wirth is here, who took the reality of Mr. Bedini and put it into hardware form. And Dr. Bob Beck is here, who has been looking into it and has cast his eyes down upon what John has done and says, it may work. And free energy is what we're talking about, an amazing device that runs, provides you with all the energy that you will need. And the efforts now are underway to make sure that that gets into your hands as soon as possible. Greg is on the line. Greg, welcome aboard.
Good evening, Bill.
I figured you'd get in on that.
I'll stay out of the out-of-body stuff and ghost stuff, the Ghostbusters, but I'll get out of this.
Okay.
The closest thing I have a chance to proving by building these circuits from John's booklets and Tom's booklets. I think it's about time someone's got together and pushed for a Tesla National Monument or Tesla Museum here. Get the guy recognized.
I think it's well worthwhile. They spent a lot of time and effort to keep him underground, but he's not underground anymore.
Mm-hmm. And name some university hall or physics lab after him or something like that. School or something.
Well, they had a Tesla Centennial this year, sponsored by one part of the IEEE, and I understand from Elizabeth Rauscher that there's very strong consideration at the present time to continue that effort, maybe on an annual basis, as a memento to Tesla.
So a Tesla convention out here on the West Coast, or the pre-energy convention. You've had them back east, and it'd be nice to have a chapter out here.
I've talked to some people who are teaching electronics on the college level, teaching it, and they didn't know who Nikola Tesla was.
Well, at least they're naming magnetic units after Tesla now.
Yeah. I noticed in the paper, almost the headlines here, had some nice earthquakes again Friday, and I wondered if you gentlemen felt them.
Yes, let me talk about that. I'm glad you mentioned that. There's been a rash within the last week, at least down what time I've been able to be outside in my work down at Huntsville. And I've been steadily photographing the giant radials I talked about before. I have a friend in Nashville who has worked out a procedure now for measuring the stuff that they're pumping the weather with when they're creating the radials. And the measurements have really been jumping for the last week or 10 days. So they're cranking the stuff up again, so I don't know what they're going to do to us, but they're going to let us have some real unpleasant weather before this thing is over.
Maybe we should backtrack just a little bit, Tom, about what you're talking about. We've talked about it before on the show, but it is your contention that the Soviet Union is pumping a type of scalar wave into a grid across the United States, and that starts doing funny things.
Yes, if you look at what we call the woodpecker signals, which Dr. Beck was one of the ones fundamentally responsible for calling strong attention to, they cranked up in the mid-70s, and if you look at the pattern of these, which our guys thinks they are over-the-horizon radars. If you look at the pattern where they intersect across the United States, across North America, in a beautiful grid pattern. We actually have the intersection pattern from a document that published how they intersect across the U.S. What we have seen, at least down in Alabama, we have seen, for example, the clouds react to this particular kind of stuff they're using, the scalar stuff. A cloud is formed of either a drop of water around a little dust particle, or if it's cold enough, a drop of ice around there. It's sort of floating up in the air, but it's a nonlinear system, and it's got a little particle of dust in there, so it's like a little semiconductor. The thing picks it up and detects it and makes a little field. And once it makes a little field, a little force field, it can move the little droplet of water. And so the little droplets of water all line up. There is some reason to believe they may be using antennas, which are very similar to one of the forms that Rogers used, which was like in a circle with radials running out from the circle. Because one of the standard patterns that these little droplets of water in the clouds form when they're doing this in a grid, they form a almost complete circle, about two-thirds of a circle that'll be about 5 miles in diameter, a little thin ring of clouds. And then outside that, little thin lines of clouds running straight away, almost like a geometer drew them, straight away for about 15 or 20 miles. That's a very unusual formation if you ever see one. And I do have photographs of one now. I don't have as good a one yet as I want, but I got a pretty good one. And I've seen at least 15 of these myself personally, and on a show here before when we opened it up to callers, people reported from all over the country having seen these radials. Mm-hmm. There's another pattern where twins get together, two of them get together and join, and in that case the rings disappear on the outside. They join on the radials, and the lines get a little fatter, and they boat tail just like a missile ogive towards the center of where the ring had been. And we've seen and been photographing recently several of those.
Can you make any of those prints available to John Ratzliff or anybody that we could get copies from somewhere?
As soon as I get one that I think is sufficiently good to convince the people that are hurling brickbats all over my head for daring to say that anybody can control the weather this way, then you bet you I'm going to publish an article on and print the pictures and the photographs and everything else. I'm using one in briefings right now.
Great. As you were, Bob Beck, done any checking on this seven-cycle Earth residence where I put up like a radio transmitter or antenna and tune to seven cycles and get free power from the Earth, or does it take more than that?
The power level is so low, it's down in the microgauss region, typically 50, 60 microgauss, that you can't extract much energy from it. It's even lower than, oh, the radio station several hundred miles away.
Mm.
But it is there. It is measurable. It's a very actual phenomena.
Is that what that L. Gordon Cooper, former astronaut, was doing? Omni Magazine mentioned he had a corporation in San Diego, which I since disappeared or something.
No, Gordon Cooper used to be my vice president in Bechtech Corporation, and I briefed him on all of these good things. And I haven't seen him in a couple of years now. We sort of went our separate ways, and I'm not sure what he's doing these days.
Well, if we could get some of this free power one way or the other, we could have electric airplanes and cars and ion-powered spaceships that could accelerate real fast and visit the planets real fast and come back and...
It'll change the world, Greg.
What
no
Gordon,
doubt about it.
What Gordon was doing was trying to, let's say, recreate some of the Tesla phenomena. I had, of course, shared with him a number of the papers that I fell heir to under very mysterious circumstances. And he knows all of the important people all over the world, and if anyone could pull it off, I think he'd be the man to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'd like to address some of John Bonini's work here. If you could later at some time leave Bill or somebody the addresses of the other men you mentioned in your latest booklet, Ken Moore, Lewis Plain, Ike Mueller, where to contact them if they're interested in talking about it. I've been able to reach Jim Watson in Colorado. He's over there now trying to tonight see if he could pick up the station. I think it's too far. He built the devices, as you mentioned in a previous show. And I also wanted to see what success you had with people buying your Energizer or duplicating your little NiCad circuit, the 5-volt NiCad that you have in your latest book, either of those two systems. I hadn't been able to build the circuit in time to say on the show whether it works or not.
Well, you're working on it, I bet you, though, Greg.
Well, I built the timer, and it doesn't work, just to power the relay. Can't get enough current to trip the relay.
Got any tips for him there, John?
I did not build the digital timer that Ike Mueller and Ken Moore did. I used the SG-1534, which is a pulse width modulator, because that fires up every time. But my NiCads, I ran them at the convention in the charge mode in front of, I guess, 500-600 engineers, and actually called Ike Mueller out of the audience and said, "Would you please come up here and measure this?" Mm-hmm. Of which Ike did, but I don't know how many people were listening out there. There was no strings. There was no big dark cloth over this thing. Anybody that wanted to measure it could measure it. In fact, I handed the schematic out. And I do have to apologize. I put the wrong number on the IC. These numbers flash around in my head all the time, and it's very rare that I ever get one number down right. But it does. It will do it, and you will find that that your switching diodes have to be extremely fast in that circuit. Otherwise, you find a short circuit current that will build there and actually short out a bank.
Are the ratings you have there the proper ones, or is there more information like the length of the wires and all?
Well, I used a 20 KC switching diode in there.
Uh-huh.
MR-852, I think it is. They use those in inverters. And I found that that diode there made it possible to run the NiCad bank. Now, with a lead-acid battery, you may have to search around and find another diode. I think Ken Moore found out that a regular automobile alternator diode worked in his circuits much more successfully than they would work in the NiCad circuits. But you have to remember one thing also, that a NiCad is not a lead acid. And the NiCad, if you heat that NiCad up, you're in danger of not charging anything. You have to keep it at a certain temperature where the lead acid can get a little bit hotter, and it'll charge.
How long has this circuit run without running down to this particular circuit with a NiCad?
Well, I ran the one with a NiCad. You'll notice that I had limiting diodes in there. I had just LEDs in there. And I did that for a reason. I didn't want to exceed 150 milliamps of charge current on these NiCads. Because if you do exceed that, what happens is they burst. In fact, I'm ready now that I might mention this, if it's all right with Bill and everybody here, that we'll be exhibiting this year at the CES show a preamplifier that runs on this particular technology that draws less than a tenth of a watt from the wall, and you can run this machine preamplifier all stages, phono stage, AUX stages, all the stages concerned, tape output, everything, for about 4 days before you have to recharge this thing, and then it charges in 15 minutes when you throw the switch. We're going to be using a very special NiCad cell. It's very fast recovery, which Panasonic now has released. And these things are good for 12 amps for 12 minutes. Okay? So you can see that little integrated circuits and things like that with this type of technology, including some discrete circuits, will run for days before it needs a charge. And then in 15 minutes, you can have it back up to charge and start playing away again. And I'll tell you what it will do. By getting rid of all the hash that's on the power lines and everything, why, the quality of these ICs goes up 100% or so.
Mm. Well, by building this exact circuit with exact parts, will it run forever, or does it run down within a couple of days? It's just highly efficient.
Okay, that's a real good question, okay? I think they have the terms mixed up, and I want to answer this question, but I want to run through something here real quick. The term perpetual motion, okay? Perpetual motion, in the way I look at it, is that that's the Earth and we're sitting on it, okay? We don't go up there and oil any bearings on the Earth, okay? But these machines, we have to grease them, we have to tighten up nuts and bolts. So the term free energy is confused with the term perpetual motion. Okay?
Assuming the parts don't wear out, or they will wear out, and you have to replace them and stuff like
that.
Well,
technically, you know, solid-state devices are supposed to go forever, right?
Yeah.
Although I've seen that there's a limit to how long they'll go. Usually they'll go between 5 and 10 years without any failure if there's nothing that comes in there and gets in there and destroys any of the junctions. Now, you know, if you happen to walk up to something and hit it with an electrostatic spark or something, you're in jeopardy of never having your circuit running.
Okay, and I'll build this exact circuit. I'll call on the show within the next few weeks and let everybody know whether it works or not.
Okay.
What frequency does it? There's an adjusting knob. Doesn't say what frequency it works at or how to adjust it.
Well, that oscillator is set. It's predetermined by that switch. You see, one says high and one says low.
Uh-huh.
The low frequency is the charge pulse mode. Okay, the high frequency is there to drive the loads. In other words, you're not going to spin a motor, you know, with 5 hertz pulses. You follow me? What you want to do is you want to spin that motor at a higher frequency. In other words, you want to get up around above 60 hertz. Okay, so you can rectify that. Almost like a standard inverter. You see, what you're looking at there is a way to take the DC power and convert it into an AC potential, and then through the rectifier convert it back to a pulse DC.
I see you have five groups in NiCad instead of the four car batteries you have later on in the booklet. I assume all five groups of 5-volt NiCads will recharge then.
Well, the fifth group of batteries was to run the oscillator, okay? Because I didn't want to draw any energy from the four banks. I wanted to make an accurate measurement of the four banks, okay? But there's also a switch there that when you throw that switch, it goes in parallel with one of the banks that one charges too.
Oh, okay, great. Has anyone successfully built, just by buying your controller, a working device by hooking it right up to a motor and away they go? Or have you heard any feedback from your controller you had for available?
No, most of them are tinkering. They're trying to do other things with them, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody has their own idea, and it's not for me to tell them about their ideas, okay? It's what they want to do with it.
Okay, Greg, does that help you?
Yeah, I'll call back if it works and let everybody know.
All right. Thank you very much.
Bye.
I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mind. We're 22 minutes past 10 o'clock with me, Tom Bearden, John C. Bedini. We have Steve Wirth and Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy and things related, and you're invited to get into it with us. Jenkins, and with me in studio is Tom Bearden, John Bedini, Steve Wirth, Dr. Bob Beck. We're talking about free energy, and Jack's on the line. Hello, Jack.
Yeah, Malibu Jack here, Bill.
Hello, Malibu.
Well, first of all, I'd like to let your guests know I'm very ecologically oriented, and I hate the idea of these damn oil companies, etc., raping Mother Nature over fossils, etc., minerals, etc., and then polluting the atmosphere, the earth, and human beings with all the products and byproducts of their damn petrochemicals.
Now,
and I'd
Jack,
like to know.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah.
All right, please say what, but be nice about it.
Yeah, okay, definitely. I'll be as sweet as I can. Okay, but I would like them to know that I am a motorcycle buff, and I'd like to know if they could possibly extrapolate upon their ideas. Now, I'm setting out a challenge for them, you see. I know that it's necessary to use gasoline right now, unfortunately. But we've seen the results of it, and I'd like to know if there would be some way to make an engine to power motorcycles, possibly even cars, without having to use gasoline. Is that possible? And I'd like to put that challenge to you, gentlemen.
That's certainly possible. I would recommend at the present time you not put it in an automobile, not because you can't do it, but because I don't think you'd be allowed to do it.
Did you leave, Jack?
Lost him.
Well, Jack's left, but why do you say we wouldn't be allowed to do it, Tom?
Just my own personal opinion is I think that the powers that be, this mysterious day, needs a lot more time to adjust the oil situation, the cash flows, the international finances and all that. And so they're going to need a few years on that. If we can free up a lot of the utilities and all, we'll ease the pressure on the oil anyway. And as a matter of fact, if you've read, even this week, if you've read anything like Business Week or something like that, you discover a very amazing fact. There is an oil glut, and a very serious one, has been. And oil is down to 20-some-odd dollars a barrel.
That's terrific. It only costs 25 cents in Saudi Arabia to get it out of the ground.
Yeah, we haven't seen any decrease at the pump. But what I'm saying is the whole thing's artificial right now anyway. They're actually closing down, going after a lot of the new strikes and new places in the U.S. because unless it's economically feasible now, as the price falls, they don't move. So there's some very strong economic pressure right now on the oil anyway to drop the price. I think we're going to see the price come down anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, I don't think we better tamper with that. We've got enough battles to fight just trying to get a home power unit. But yes, indeed, you can... You can build a power unit for an engine for a motor, for a motorcycle. You can also build it for a car or an airplane. As a matter of fact, the West Germans did exhibit a prototype little bitty motorcycle engine running down the highway using an energizer. It was electrically powered. It had a lot of flaws in it, a lot of bugs in it, but they did show that they could run the motorcycle approximately four times as far as the battery could possibly power it. They demonstrated that to a German government agency. And I don't really know at this time what's happened to that. That seems to be still hung up in the bugs and so forth.
I keep burning up the batteries.
I had an interesting aside on this. When Gordon Cooper and I were rather closely associated, he was trying to get alcohol fuel into the mainstream. And I was amazed to find that prior to World War I, almost all the tractors, automobiles, had carburetors that would work on either alcohol or gasoline. And this was rather dangerous to the Rockefeller and the petroleum industry. And I was absolutely amazed to find that the oil companies had enough clout to alter the Constitution of the United States. The Volstead Act prohibition was mounted not because the Women's Christian Temperance Union was angry with drunks, but they were trying to close down all of the backyard stills that would make the farmers independent, and the masquerade, the cover story was...
I've never heard that. That's
now, this is a part of our history that I'm sure you never learned in school, so don't underestimate the oil companies. They changed the Constitution of the United States to preserve their monopoly.
Well, that's certainly true, and it's also true that during World War II, for example, we've had technology as old as that. Hitler was able to fuel the German war machine almost entirely with synthetic fuel made from coal.
Right.
But he had to have tetraethyl lead in order to make it the Luftwaffe planes work, and he got that from the United States.
Right.
It was wonderful.
But the funny thing is, you know, we have all those captured German papers, and as far as I know, they've never... even allowed the processes
the Germans
were using to be translated.
The processes, by the way, all of those papers are in the School of Petroleum Engineering at Texas A&M University.
Yeah, they're there. They're still there. In other words, any time we decided we really wanted to do it, we could certainly build synthetic fuel. And I believe the price quoted is a little cheaper than what we're paying for gasoline today.
They'd figure out a way to jump it up, I'm sure. It's 10:30 and Bob is on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
I'll address my question to John.
Yes.
John, recently I just got a $200 electric bill, so I, like many of your listeners, would like to know just how much more research has to be done before we can expect this thing to be put on the market or either bought up by some of the larger firms, Westinghouse or GE or whatever.
That won't happen.
Well, that's a tough question because don't feel lonely out there because mine just jumped from... $120 to $225 this month. So, but I think that has to do with they don't actually come in your backyard. What they do is they peer over your back fence with a little scope, and sometimes they mismark the numbers. But if you're curious about that, just call them up, and they'll be glad to send a man out with his loads and everything and test your meter. But my research work is basically complete at this time on what I've been working on. It's led me to some other work, okay?
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be real important right at this time. And but the capability, the possibility there is that the generator could do it. Well, let's look at it this way. It is possible right at this point in time with a few bars of iron and a couple of coils to put in 500 watts and get 1,000 watts worth of heat out, if that would help you. But I think it would help the Midwest much more, especially those people that can't afford the coal, right, or the oil. The machine in its crude form, I have not been able to break. I have not been able to short it out. I've been not able to overheat it in any way, so it looks like in its crude form it could, you know, supply some type of heating, but unfortunately the funding right there right at this moment to get it into production isn't there right now.
Efforts are being made, underway.
Has any interest been shown overseas?
The answer is yes.
I think I'll have Bill or Tom answer that.
Okay.
Yes, the answer is very definitely yes. We'd rather not elaborate on that at the present time.
But okay, work is going on. You can rest assured about that, all right?
Mm-hmm. One last question. I missed the, failed to understand where this energy is derived from. How does the machine capture the energy?
To put it real simply, the vacuum is full of enormous amounts of energy in a very special form, a locked-up form. If you take the vacuum inside the machine, in the vicinity of the machine, and you sort of warp the vacuum, if you'll imagine that for a moment, mm-hmm. imagine that the vacuum is a special kind of little particles in flux, almost like pressure in the molecules in the gas, mm-hmm. only we call them virtual particles. And imagine, call that an ether. That's an acceptable term anymore. It's finally come back in. Imagine that what we do is we make a higher pressure ether in one part of the machine than is in the other part. And then the ether itself then forms a river between those two parts. Now, what we do really do is we tap that river. And the river is coming from nature. Nature's boundless energy. It's like being in an ocean and you tap the tops of the waves. You get some waves going and you tap the tops of them. Nature's providing the energy. And it's right there in the vacuum. That's where it's coming from. The physics verifies that the energy is there. We know today it's there in enormous amounts. And that's the way you get just a little bit of it. You got to bend things so that you get a little river and you tap the river.
Does that help you, Bob?
It does. One last question. Where can we get some literature? You mentioned that you had a book. Is that available in most bookstores? Or?
All right. There are some papers that both Tom and John have written. You can get those from the Tesla Book Company at 1580 Magnolia, Millbrae, California, M-I-L-L-B-R-E-A.
A-E.
All right, get corrected there by the scientist. 94030 is the zip code up there.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And we have, I guess Richard is on the line. Hello, Richard.
Hello, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of all of yours.
Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
I have a question for John and a question for Dr. Bearden. And for Bob, too. In fact, for Bob, my question is, when do you answer your phone machine, if ever?
we've all been wondering about that.
That's a good question, Bob. When do you answer that phone system?
Oh, nightmare time. I must have got...
This is your conscience speaking.
Thank you, Uncle Richard. I've been the guest of a medical group in Minneapolis for a while. When I got back to town, I was just appalled at the traffic that had piled up years and years ago. I told any one of my secretaries who ever called me to the telephone would be fired on the spot. I don't know. I apologize for this. About once a day we go through 50 to 100 calls, see if there's anything there, and call back about 50% of them. So we'll get back to you sooner or later.
Okay, thanks. I've been building Tesla coils lately and becoming fascinated with induction. John, does your system work on the principle of induction?
Yes.
Is it high frequency, high voltage induction?
No. Not necessarily. But it does work on the principle of induction.
Well, my next project is going to be to try to build one of your devices.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything I need to know? To start,
yeah.
When you say the vacuum, now, is this a vacuum that you created, a blown piece of glass with a vacuum of some type?
No.
No, okay. What do you mean when you say the vacuum?
I think I'll turn that question over to Tom.
Okay, thanks.
But, Tom, can we put the vacuum in some term that might be easy, you know, might turn on some light bulbs out there?
Yeah, imagine a...
also...
Imagine the empty space in front of you. We know there's air out there, right?
Right.
Now, pull all the air out. That's left is what we call the vacuum.
Okay, and how does that apply to the actual device?
Okay, the vacuum is a thing that's been of enormous importance in physics for an awfully long time. They used to call it the ether, and now they're back to calling it the ether again. That went out of fashion, went out of favor for a long time, but now they're calling it that again. The vacuum, it turns out, the best way to model that is to imagine that it's filled with a whole bunch of little particles just going like crazy in every direction. These particles appear and disappear. They come into being, and they disappear from being. And that's what the vacuum is, a flux of these magic little particles which are going crazy, going in all directions all the time. That's the way modern physics represents the vacuum, and they call these virtual particles. They come into being so quickly, and they go out of being so quickly, that normally we can't measure one of them being there. But we can measure a whole bunch of them if they get together and gang up, so to speak, and clobber something. And physics today
visualizes that all the forces of nature are caused by exchange of these little virtual particles doing just that with masses. And they make forces when they do that. That's the way they model it.
Okay, and then I did have a question for you. Could you clarify for me maybe the difference between the spatial potential in the third and the fourth dimension, where the space-time comes into play with the scalar width? I'm reading your work right
yes,
now.
Yes, time is a funny thing. That's a very deep question you asked, and it'll take me just a moment to answer that. So please bear with me.
Definitely.
Time is a very funny thing. In the geometry that was originated to make a model and apply to relativity by Minkowski, time is used as a dimension. In other words, you make length, width, and height like you're normally used to seeing, and they say, hey, there's another right angle there, and we call that time. And it's a little bit more complicated than that, but basically that's it. And so they built what they call a four-dimensional geometry, and they call that space-time. In other words, four dimensions. Space being L cubed, or length, time length, time length, and then times time gives you space-time. Now, in quantum mechanics, time is not an observable. What that means is you can't detect time. There's never been such a thing as a clock in the true sense. You see spatial positioning, for example, when you look at a hand. You see the two hands of a clock. And if you see a change in the spatial position of the hands on that clock, you infer that time has passed. Now, you may infer that very precisely if you use instruments, but you don't measure the time itself. You actually measure the spatial positioning on the hands. You measure something spatially always, according to quantum mechanics. So we have a quandary when we start talking about measuring something. Because here we have models that says, well, the world is made up of space-time, this thing that came from relativity. And yet every time we measure, we only measure a part of that. We lose the time, you see. So that's one of the reasons that quantum mechanics and relativity have never really been quite well patched together. They're still not quite as patched together as they should be. Anyway, the space-time business... what you're reading in my papers is in the old days they didn't know about you could change the rate of flow of a thing through time. That came along with relativity. Well, they put together the foundations of electromagnetics long before relativity came along, and they made it entirely spatial. So they made the idea of the electrostatic scalar potential, it became a spatial thing. And what I pointed out is, say, hey guys, take that Minkowski geometry, use the four dimensions. Well, the electrostatic scalar potential is a stress on all four. Hmm. It's not just the stress in space. That's what I'm pointing out in that paper.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, Richard, I'm glad that helped you.
Perfect. Thank you very much for your show.
You betcha.
Good night.
Greg, you're on.
Hello, Bill.
Well, you made it.
Oh, it's wonderful. I thought we'd never talk again, but your producer came through.
Oh, very, very good. Clout.
I basically was planning on concentrating on the economics, but I have a couple of things I have to get in quickly. And by the way, I have to make an observation here. I mean, I can remember, 10, 15 years ago, as a rather young person, learning just the basic idea of virtual particles, and it seemed evident to me at the time that we exist in kind of an energy matrix in the universe. And if that was clear to me then, it's kind of surprising that so many people have trouble figuring that out.
You were a little avant-garde, I think.
I don't know. I mean, it seems like a very obvious concept.
Okay.
anyways, let me just ask you a couple of things quickly. First of all, Tom, you were just saying you were just using the term ether. You're not really using it in the way that it used to be used, are you?
No, that's correct. They used to think of the ether as being a material, that is, an observable ether. It was very thin, very ethereal, but it was there and it was real and it was observable by your instruments. Today, that's not the way they visualize it. It's visualized as totally being virtual particle flux. And
all
so
right.
The difference is, the change is, it's a virtual gas now instead of an observable, thin observable gas.
I was just wondering if it might not be a good idea to come up with a better term, because that could be misleading for a lot of people who are familiar with the old concept.
Well, I agree, but the term has come back into existence in physics. It is now being used in physics papers, published in journals, and is an accepted term because it's now understood in the modern sense.
So they're just redefining it.
They just redefined it. That's correct.
Good. Now, one other thing. we get to economics, I was interested, my ears really perked up when you mentioned Richard Feynman a ways back, because I have the highest regard for him, both as a scientist and as a human being. And I just wonder if you could elaborate on his connection. I guess it's basically with the theoretical basis of this. I gathered from what you were saying that he hasn't really...
No, as a matter of fact, one of the real inspirations for me has been Feynman's three volumes of physics. You can get excellent theoretical treatments of physics in many books, but Feynman has probably, in that series of books, has done a better job than almost anybody else I know of in expressing the actual concepts in a manner in which you can understand them. If you read the book about the concepts, you can begin to see a little deeper into what the things really mean than the normal physics text gives you. It's a very excellent series of books, and that's my connection with Feynman was in reading his three volumes of physics.
I was just wondering if you could elaborate on his connection with the concepts that connect with free energy systems.
I don't think he's connected with them. I think Dr. Beck, pointed out that when approached by a former student of his, he did not recall writing the Baum-Aronoff material in those three books. This was some years later, of course.
Right. Okay. Well, let's talk about economics then. Have you got any kind of rough plans for scaling these devices up to industrial size, shall we say?
The answer is yes.
Do you have estimates as to the capital costs?
Well, we're getting pretty particular here, Greg. I'd really rather not go into the real specifics of that because we're trying to do some negotiations, and I don't want to do anything or say anything that might reflect on those. Let me put it this way. I don't see any obstacles. The principles are there, and they are scalable. Let's put it that way. There doesn't seem to be any problem in scaling, particularly the devices that John has right now.
No problem.
Uh-huh. Let's say a scenario of maybe not an ideal future, but what you could best expect to happen. What percentage of the present energy use could be substituted with free energy devices?
Maybe I can answer that question from some of the measurements that I made. Okay. Let's look at it this way. You probably only need one generator the size of what's in Boulder Dam down below. And you could probably take care of three-quarters of the United States.
You're talking about the electrical need?
Yes. You could probably take care of three-quarters of the United States. And you'd have to find some way... you'd have to make such a big output port because what this thing does is as the power needs increase... In the U.S., what would happen is you would find out that the water was being pushed through the turbine or sucked through the turbine rather than the turbine being pushed.
It turns back, it goes backwards, yeah.
It's sort of a back EMF type generator, okay? In other words, it's you view it this way, okay? Take your hand and stick it over the end of a vacuum cleaner, and what happens when you stick your hand over the intake port of that vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, the airflow increases.
That's right, but the motor speeds up, right?
I never really checked that out, I guess,
Well, you check that out sometime, you'll find out that the motor races away, but yet your hand's still stuck to the end, okay?
I see what you're saying, sure.
That's exactly what this generator does. The bigger the demand load on it, the faster it wants to turn. So the governor effect would be the water that the turbine's sucking in on initial start. In other words, you'd have to find... Well, I'm sure they could do it. Mechanics is great, but you would have to limit the port on the output of the turbine, in other words, to control the speed of the generator, or otherwise you would find yourself with sucking the dam dry.
Yes, but you wouldn't necessarily want to put this all in one large generator, would you?
Certainly. Certainly you would.
For what reason?
Well, why have 40,000 generators all over the place?
Well, for backup. I could give you a number of reasons why.
Well, let me hear one of yours.
Well, if it fails, that's it, right? That's the first obvious one. But second of all, you've got to...
Let me point out one thing right now. I will make this claim.
Okay.
You cannot short this generator out. If you short it out, it speeds up. Okay? There is no more power if you short it out. You follow what I'm telling you?
Yeah, I understand that.
So therefore, the only failure that could occur on this would be a burned-out bearing or a broken main shaft, okay?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, so what you would need is maybe two of these generators, then one just standing there doing nothing, right?
Okay. Well, what about
they have a bunch of turbines at Boulder Dam.
Right, I mean, they got how many generators sitting in there right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Maybe a whole bank of them. What I'm suggesting is that if you're going to build one and you want to supply power, then build a big enough one that can carry this power. Also, you will find out with this kind of generator that you need one wire. We are supplying loads right now with number 30 wire.
Size of your hair, smaller.
Okay.
Wow. So you're saying basically then your concept would be we'd have to upgrade the energy grid to handle this? And...
Well, I don't think the normal energy grid, okay? You see, the normal energy grid is a two-wire system, okay? We don't push any electrons in this system. We just let them go by themselves. In other words, the smaller the wire, the more energy we seem to derive from this mechanism, okay?
It's backwards.
Yeah, it's a backwards generator. In other words, as I explained earlier in the program, the lower the load impedance, the generator becomes proportional to the load. In other words, if the resistor is, say, 4 ohms and the resistor is rated at 25 watts, that's exactly what you're going to find that the generator puts to the resistor. However, if you increase the resistance on this type of generator, you will find out that as you increase the resistance, the power is increased also, which is completely backwards from what we know.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, by the way, have you come across anything in that, you know, any previous theoretical physics that would point to such a happenstance?
Well, yeah, yes, it's Tom Bearden has pointed that out many times, that the answers already lie in these books. It's just we don't seem to pay attention to them for some reason.
The problem is the answers are in about 4 or 5 different fields or different places that have not been connected except by, you know, you have the individual researchers like John Medina, like Dr. Beck and so forth, that have put fields together that in the textbooks and in the common teachings are not put together. That's the problem.
I wonder if an equivalent there would be a constant current analog. If you have an infinite impedance source, it will put the identical current into any load because the source impedance is much higher than the load.
It works somewhat similar to that.
Yes, it does. It's also a series resonance system. So whatever the load power requires, you will find that exact duplicate in the generator itself.
Reflected?
It's a reflected power, and this is what enables the generator to accelerate because the magnetic fields, more or less, become the same poles then. You follow what I'm saying so far? In other words, the generator, if you have a north pole and a south pole on a generator, and it was a series resonance system, what would happen is the bigger magnetic field overpowers the little magnetic field, and so the smaller magnetic field wants to repel from the bigger one because it wants to become the same light pole. Do you follow what I'm telling you?
Are you with us there, Greg?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure on the last part. I'm taping this. I'm going to have to...
There you go.
Yeah, I go over it again. All right, Greg, does that help?
Well, I'll just leave you with one other part of the economics or... You had a question before about using it to substitute for gasoline. I'm just wondering, so far you've just been concentrating on implementing this in the electrical generating system, but what about other energies since electricity is only rather small portion of our overall energy?
First things first, I guess, is the best way to look at it.
Well, it has an enormous number of applications, and this I will not go into on the air, but...
I always ask these questions.
No, I'm going to give you where it leads, for example, to give you some idea. If you begin to look at what we're calling scalar waves, this vector zero, and you can imagine that as a potential that increases and decreases but never allows a gradient. That's one way to look at it. The gradient always remains horizontal. Another way to look at it is a potential and a whole system rises equally across the system. all the same thing. But if you have that rising and falling, you find that you have a wave. Now, what a mass is in the first place, a particle of mass, is nothing in the world but a standing scalar wave, not the normal electromagnetic wave at all, but a standing zero wave. Once you understand that, you can build currents of scalar resonance. You can suck the mass and inertia right out of an object, or you can put mass and inertia into an object by currents that you can flow through wires, and at that point, I won't say any more.
Well, that ought to help you as you go over your tape recorder there, Greg.
You know, you just sparked up one last thing, and I'm going to hang up. This is a real, this is out of left field. Do you see any application for anything, for deriving from anything you've been working on that would enable us to neutralize nuclear weapons?
Well, let's put it this way. You could get rid of all those hot waste that we're piling up and we've got to find some place to store. And can you neutralize nuclear weapons? Yes, indeed, 100%.
You're talking about interfering with radioactive decay or what?
Yes. I'm also talking about dudding electromagnetic circuits at a distance. You know, if they're harmful circuits like what's going to bring a nuke down on top of your head, you can do that. You can do a lot of other things. You can put so much energy on the thing that you just melt everything or vaporize it.
It's a wonderful thing.
You're saying there's a direct interaction or coupling with the forces that govern radiation?